Welcome to the Paediatric Physical Therapy Podcast. I'm Peter Goodwin to bring you a taste of what's in the latest edition of the journal. Later in the programme, we'll hear about a novel exoskeleton to help children make arm movements.
The great thing that we found is that it did improve function for the child immediately when we put it on within a session. So he was better able to play and look at things and have them in his hands and reach for things. And across time, what we were most excited about is that he ended up getting stronger even without it on.
And also there's news about a way children, just like adults, can benefit from going down to the gym and training in a group.
In terms of our motor outcomes, we had significant improvements in gross motor skills, and we also had significant improvement in how much support the children, how much less support the children needed.
And on the line from Maine is our editor, Linda Fetters of the University of Southern California. We'll be listening together to the comments of authors from the latest edition of Paediatric Physical Therapy Journal. Linda, any thoughts about this edition before we get started?
Yes, Peter. Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Good. The wanted to make a comment about the use of the exoskeleton. In the journal, we have clinical bottom lines for each of our research articles. And in the article on exoskeleton, the father of the child in that article wrote a part of the clinical bottom line, which is very insightful in terms of what that exoskeleton what his son was able to do with the exoskeleton on. So I encourage you to read that clinical bottom line.
Right. I think it's all very, very interesting. Let's begin with a success story here. Two children with benign paroxysmal positional vertigo were tested using special goggles, accurately diagnosed, and then remedied with a physical maneuver. Jenny Fay from New York has been telling me how.
We have infrared goggles here that we use to evaluate eye movements, and I was able to test these children using the goggles and putting them into the Dix-Hallpike position, which is just having the patient lie supine with their head rotated and extended over the back of the table. And when you put the patient into that position, if they have benign paroxysmal positional vertigo, they will demonstrate eye movement called nystagmus, and they'll have complaints of vertigo. So it will reproduce their symptoms.
And what did you find, in fact?
I can determine where the crystals are loose and do a treatment for that, an appropriate treatment to reposition the crystals back into place.
Right. So what, in fact, did you do with these children?
So I was able to determine that they did have crystals loose in the left posterior canal of their vestibular system. And I did a repositioning maneuver using gravity and the position of their head. And it's sometimes referred to as the Epley maneuver. But more commonly now it's called the Canaleth repositioning maneuver or Canaleth repositioning treatment. And it's just a simple body positioning treatment to move the crystals back into place, and then that resolves their symptoms.
And how successful, in fact, in the case of these children, was this remedy?
It was very successful, actually. Both children improved in their symptoms. They reported that they were free of their vertigo after only a few maneuvers. One of them, actually, it just took one trial of the maneuver. The 11-year-old child did take a little bit longer to resolve, but both of them, their symptoms were resolved with this maneuver.
So what are the clinical lessons maybe coming out of your experience here?
I think for the important point that I wanted to present with this case report is that for patients who have complaints of vertigo, they should be screened by doing this test because it's a simple way to determine if they have BPPV. And if they do have BPPV, then you can treat it in the clinic and it can really help the patients with their symptoms.
Jennifer Fay, neurologic clinical specialist at Rusk Rehabilitation, New York University, New York. In Boston, four adolescent boys with Duchenne muscular dystrophy were the subjects of a study looking at the potential benefit to them of supported standing. And the author, Elise Townsend, gave me a cautious green light to the use of supported standing techniques for some patients, but perhaps not all.
This is the first study that empirically is looking at the impact of supported standing. So we need to know if it's safe. We need to know if boys are tolerating it, and if so, which boys tolerate it well and which ones don't, to begin to make predictions about who we should prescribe or recommend supported standing for.
Fantastic. So what did you do?
We looked at four boys and prescribed them a supported standing program. We measured them at baseline over a number of weeks and then implemented a supported standing program for them at home, and continued to measure after the program ended to try and see and look at patterns over time and get a sense for the impact that standing might have, as well as its safety and tolerability.
And you're doing this in quite a sophisticated way, looking at muscle length, bone mineral density, and so on. What did you find?
Well, we found that in terms of safety, for our sample, our findings support safety of supported standing programs, specifically with a monitored program that's done at home with the device that we chose. In terms of tolerability, we found that not all boys with Duchenne muscular dystrophy will tolerate standing, but some of them will. And so the factor that we identified that is the best predictor of not being a good candidate for standing is having ankle plantar flexion contractures that are greater to or equal to 15 to 20 degrees. Now, again, this is in a small sample, so we can't necessarily generalize that to the larger sample of boys with Duchenne, but that describes a finding we had in our sample.
And you did get good improvements, didn't you?
Some of the boys did show improvements alongside a supported standing program, particularly with respect to muscle length of the hip flexors and muscle length of the knee flexors.
So what would you say are the conclusions of your study?
Well, supported standing can be safe for boys with muscular dystrophy. It can also be well tolerated for boys that have mild contractures of the hip, knee, and ankle, but it may not be well tolerated for boys who have more marked plantar flexion contractures.
So what messages would you pass on to your fellow clinicians?
Well, first and foremost, I think we need more research to have additional information about the tolerability and be able to predict which boys are going to tolerate standing and which boys aren't. The second is we need more information about the efficacy, like what are the impacts, particularly at the activities and participation level, not just at the impairment level. What is the impact of standing for at those levels of the ICF model? I think physical therapists should be considering supported standing programs in boys in the late ambulatory and non-ambulatory stages, and should focus on ankle plantar flexor muscle length and maintaining that in order to optimize the chances that a supported standing program is possible.
That was Elise Townsend, who's an associate professor at the MGH Institute of Health Professions in Boston. Children with neurodevelopmental impairment who are late at learning how to walk might benefit from the sort of group-based treadmill program that's reported in another study from the fall edition of the journal. Katrine Matten-Baxter from Sacramento explained to me what they set out to investigate.
We were trying to see if a group-based treadmill training program could help children with their walking skills, children who were not walking yet or who were walking with an assistive device. And we have some evidence that home-based treadmill training works well, and also some evidence that non-home-based, facility-based treadmill training works in these children. But we wanted to see if a group exercise program would be an efficient way to engage children in walking activities on mini treadmills. So we looked at outcomes on gross motor skills related to standing and walking in particular, and how much support the children needed for ambulation. We also wanted to see how much the program was actually being used by the families and how the parents felt about such a program.
What did you do? You looked at 12 children, didn't you?
So we had 12 children enrolled for a semester at our university in a program that was group-based. the parents came, were scheduled for a 30-minute intervention time, and we had three groups of about four children coming at the same time. And we had them walk on the treadmill. We individualized the treadmill training for each child based on their needs and their skill. So in terms of speed, in terms of duration, and also sometimes we added other things such as an incline or ankle weights. And we had the children, we pushed the children very hard on the treadmill, and the group-based setting meant that several children walked at the same time with several parents in the room and several doctor of physical therapy students and myself.
And what results did you get?
So what we found is, in terms of, you know, our motor outcomes, we had significant improvements in gross motor skills, and we also had significant improvement in how much support the children, how much less support the children needed, and how much they relied on their caregivers for their mobility needs. And we did not see an improvement in walking speed, but many of the children walked more independently, but they might have walked slower than maybe, for example, a child with a walker might have walked now slower, but independently. And we got a very, very good reviews from the parents. The parents were very happy with the program and thought that it was a reasonable amount of time to spend in a program such as this, and that the motivational factor was great because it was not just an individual session, but a group-based program. But we were not able to measure that directly from the child perspective.
So what you're saying is that it was fun and it was useful to be a member of a class rather than doing things on your own.
That was kind of what we set out to. That's what we thought would happen, and it was confirmed by the families. Now, from the child perspective, we don't have any data, but of course we made lots of informal observations, and we were, it was a very fun environment. We tried to make the children happy. They got to play, they got to blow bubbles, they got to reach for things, they got to look at iPads and listen to music. We pretty much did whatever was necessary to make the child happy. And so it was a very fun kind of preschool type environment.
Katrine Matten-Baxter, an associate professor in the Department of Physical Therapy at California State University in Sacramento. Well, I'd like to bring our editor, Linda Fetters, Linda, in on the conversation at this point. Linda, I wonder what you make of what we've been hearing so far.
Peter, a lot of very interesting work. I wanted to highlight again the clinical bottom line that was written regarding the article by Elise Townsend and colleagues, Supported Standing in Boys with Duchenne Muscular Dystrophy. The clinical bottom line in reference to that article was authored in part by a young man who has Duchenne Muscular Dystrophy, and he discusses his experience with the type of treatment that Dr. Townsend and colleagues have implemented. And it's very insightful. One of the things we're really trying to increase in the journal is for parents and for children and young adults to contribute their stories and their interpretation of the research and the clinical practice of physical therapy.
Because it is very much a team effort, isn't it, between carers, parents, and physical therapists?
Yes, absolutely. And parents can give us quite a bit of insight as to the direction for our research, the application of our research to clinical practice. And I think it's a very important voice for us to listen to as both researchers and clinicians. Mm.
I was struck by the fact that you can cure vertigo just by a maneuver. That's very helpful, isn't it?
It's quite remarkable. And I think the testing and the specificity of the treatment is really quite remarkable. Mm.
And the image of children enjoying themselves on a treadmill, that sounds like a lot of fun too.
It does sound fun. And I think increasingly, similar to Dr. Matten-Baxter's project, we're seeing that group-based and fun activities are essential for children to continue to engage in an exercise program.
Well, now let's have a look at something else, Linda, then, because we've been reading in the journal, if you give children with physical disability external support to help them reach for objects and maintain postures. This could be a real benefit, but it's one that's been under-researched, according to author Victor Santa Maria from New York. He's been studying the use of segmental trunk support in 17 children with cerebral palsy, and his research, published in the journal, found that to improve motor performance, you need to match the external assistance to the child's intrinsic level of trunk control.
Depending on the level of support that you provide, the child will show more or less proficiency for controlling independent sitting control and also reaching, because that was the task that we investigated. We investigated the ability to control posture and arm during reaching when we presented a toy. While providing this level of trunk support, all the kids went through all these three levels of trunk support, and then we performed our kinematic analysis.
Right. In the analysis, then, what did you discover about the effectiveness of this trunk support?
As we hypothesized, we didn't observe differences across levels of trunk support for those children with mild trunk dysfunction. I would like to mention again that these children were independent sitters. They didn't present severe trunk dysfunctions. However, what we observed is that when the level of trunk support matches the region of the trunk where the deficit occurs, the quality in the control of posture and reaching substantially improves. In the severe group, we show that children with severe trunk dysfunctions presented an improved head control when the level of support was provided at axillary level, you know, like the highest level of trunk support. And in the group with moderate trunk dysfunctions, what we observe is that when the level of support was provided at axillary or midrib compared to pelvic, they displayed better postural control and reaching control.
So coming out of this then, what are the messages, the take-home messages for physical therapists?
Well, the co-authors of this research and I think that physical therapists should systematically evaluate postural trunk control in children with cerebral palsy and GMFCS levels 4 and 5 with the SATCO. Once the region of the trunk at which the child loses balance control is identified, then the therapist can match the external level of support to the identified trunk segment. In this way, the physical therapist just provides sufficient postural support while promoting maximal independent control of upper body during therapy or while the child is practicing activities of daily living.
I was talking with Victor Santa Maria from Teachers College, Columbia University, about research he and his colleagues did at the University of Oregon. The benefit that stretching exercises can bring to children with neuromuscular disabilities has been lacking an evidence base, according to Jason Craig. So he and his co-workers in British Columbia have now published a systematic review of studies assessing the effects of stretching exercises.
We found three green interventions. So the three big findings we found is that ankle serial casting increases ankle range of motion. The other second major finding is we found that orthoses, so ankle orthoses, increase ankle range of motion when worn while walking. And the last green intervention was that supported standing programs improve lower extremity bone mineral density. All other findings were defined as yellow interventions, meaning that there was either low level or conflicting evidence to support the intervention. And the good thing was that we did not find any red interventions, meaning there's no stretch intervention that either is unsafe or ineffective.
Now, what would you say are your conclusions about the effectiveness of these various stretch interventions?
So I'd say as a whole, there it's not something to stop as a treatment intervention. It's definitely something in a physiotherapist's toolkit to continue to use as a part of a comprehensive exercise program. So you're not just going to provide a stretching program to a child. You're going to prescribe, you know, stretching, balance exercise, and strengthening exercises. I think there's still a role to prescribe stretch interventions, but I think as physical therapists, we do need to do a better job of actually assessing the participation and quality of life for all the treatment interventions that we're doing. I think that's something that really needs to be looked at to justify the service that we're providing.
So what do you think are the big practical messages to take home for physical therapists from this?
So I think one is the research. So I think we need to maybe collaborate and put all of our look at like CP databases to actually look at prospective cohorts, to look at some better studies, you know, measuring children starting from now and looking forward several years out. And then those three green interventions are something that you could definitely justify to parents when you're treating their children. And all other interventions, if you are going to use them, you need to do a really good job of using functional outcome measures to justify why you're actually using those stretch interventions.
That was Jason Craig, who's a physiotherapist at the Queen Alexandra Centre for Children's Health in Victoria, Canada. Also in the latest edition of Paediatric Physical Therapy Journal, there's a report on the use of a novel exoskeleton to help an infant learn to crawl, reach and play with toys. The lead author is Michelle Lobo from Delaware, and I asked her what their exoskeleton consisted of and what they were trying to do in this particular case.
This study was unique because it was the first time that we have used any of these exoskeletons on an infant. So the infant that we saw was 8 months old, and he has a diagnosis called arthrogryposis. And what that means is just in utero, around 6 to 8 weeks, he had trouble moving. And that movement, limited movement, continued throughout his time in utero and after birth. So for his arms and his legs, he ended up being born with significant contractures. He had to do a lot of stretching to get out of that. He had a lot of weakness. And by the time we saw him at 8 months, he should have been crawling around, using his arms for crawling. He should have been very easily using his arms to reach for toys, because you start doing that around 3 or 4 months of age. And he couldn't do any of those things. His arms were just kind of resting down at his side. He could move them down in that area by his hips, but he couldn't lift them. So our goal was to see if we could use these exoskeletons a little bit differently than some people have been using them. So we think of them as assistive devices that you have to wear all the time, and they improve your function when you have them on. And we wanted to see if that would be true for him. But we also wanted to see if he used it at home to play each day, could we progressively give him less assistance and more challenging activities and make him improve even when he didn't have it on?
What in fact happened then?
So, well, and the third thing was to even see if these were feasible, because we didn't know, would the family like it? Would the family be able to use it? Would it fit in a real world setting? So the first thing we found was that the family did use it on a daily basis. There were many things the family didn't like about it in terms of comfort, appearance, ease of use. And those are things that we really need to listen to improve these devices. But the great thing that we found is that it did improve function for the child immediately when we put it on within a session. So he was better able to play and look at things and have them in his hands and reach for things. And across time, what we were most excited about is that he ended up getting stronger even without it on. So even though at 8 months he wasn't able to lift his arms well at all against gravity, he gained movement against gravity across time, and he also gained function. So he was able to start reaching for things if you presented them up at his chest level, whereas he had never been able to do that before. So for us, that was really exciting, because it's almost like when people are working with someone that had a spinal cord injury, or, you know, and they took their first step, that for us was that kind of moment, because he had never reached before and all that time, and he did that after the intervention. So we were excited.
Yeah. So what do you think, however, might happen in the long term with the use of such an exoskeleton?
Yeah, so we are studying that right now, actually. We're following several kids, 30-something kids. I think we're up to 36 now, kids with arthrogryposis. We're also following infants who have been born with brain injury and have trouble moving. And so we're following them across time to see how this intervention impacts multiple kids, if it has the same effect. And we're seeing similar findings in this population. And I think in terms of long-term impact, I think of it as training. So if you are significantly a poor runner and you want to be a better runner, you could dedicate this year to being a really good runner, and you'll be a better runner by the end of the year.
Could you sum this up in just a few seconds of what are the take-home points that clinicians should bear in mind about the potential use of an exoskeleton? Very, very briefly.
Yep. So the key points are that we can use these in the home environment for families for daily training, that they can improve function within a session, and across time, they can improve function when you're not wearing it, if you use it the right way.
Michelle Lobo, assistant professor at the University of Delaware in Newark. The new edition of Pediatric Physical Therapy also examines another important issue that's been under-researched: the effect of restraining devices such as car seats on children with typical development and those considered at risk of developmental delay. Beth Smith, with her colleagues Crystal Jang and Joyce Armendi, looked at a group of 26 infants to check on the effects devices like car seats had on ankle movements.
We had 26 infants total, so there were 13 with typical development and 13 at risk for developmental delay. And we put them in a car seat for 4 minutes. We put them under a gym for 4 minutes and also in the supine position for 4 minutes. And those conditions were in a random order between different infants. And then we measured how many times they moved their legs.
So what did you find then?
We found that the infants moved their legs less frequently when they were in the car seat compared to being in the gym.
And what did this imply?
Well, we have a direct measure now that putting infants in a car seat has an immediate effect to decrease the frequency with which they move their legs. What we don't know is what the long-term effects of that are or what the threshold would be for when that would start to have an effect on their movement or development. So clearly infants need to be in car seats, but presumably there would be some point in time when restricting their movement for a long period of time could have an effect on their development, but that remains to be seen.
I think that's really worth knowing about. So how would you propose that this should in fact be applied in terms of daily practice?
Well, there are a couple things we need to figure out first. So what we need to do is prospectively collect information about how frequently infants are in car seats, so how often, for what period of time, and whether or not that tends to be different between infants with typical development, infants at risk for developmental delay. And then once we have a very good sense of how long infants are in car seats, also look at their development and see if there's a relationship or an association between how long they're in car seats, what their developmental rate is. And then beyond that, the next step is to have to directly manipulate how long they're in car seats. So if we show an association between, say, for example, spending above a certain amount of time in a car seat seems to relate to delays in development, we would then need to directly manipulate and do an intervention to reduce time in car seats to see if that would then affect developmental rate.
Right. Well, this is a very elegant study, well-balanced with 26 infants in two different groups. Give me a provisional message then to take home.
Well, my provisional message would be that we now have shown that putting infants in a car seat has an immediate effect on their leg movement rate. So you can recommend to families, if you're trying to increase the amount of movement activity that an infant has, you can recommend that they try to limit the amount of time the infant is in the car seat as much as they can, with, of course, keeping the infant safe well when the infant needs to be in a car seat.
I was talking with Beth Smith, Assistant Professor of Research at the University of Southern California, Los Angeles. And I'd like to bring in our editor, Linda Fetters, again at this point for a comment or two. We seem to have opened up quite a few fascinating issues, Linda. What do you make of them?
Yes, they really are interesting, Peter. I think one important message from each of the studies is the importance of the context for movement. So in Dr. Santa Maria's research, really the context of how is the trunk being supported, where does the trunk need support, really affects measurement and the competence of reaching behavior. And then we see in Michelle Lobo's and Beth Smith's and group work, the importance of an exoskeleton, the importance of various devices on the movement that's produced. So that in addition to focusing on the quality and quantity of a particular movement, we really have to look at the context, not just the context within the body, but what's the environment in which the activities are happening.
Any overall message for physical therapists coming out of this edition then from you, Linda?
I think the overall message that I took from many of these studies was the importance of movement within the typical context for children, so that it matters. We can change a lot of what happens just by shifting infants from a car seat to the floor, from enabling infants to improve their reaching by giving certain support at the trunk, or by providing an exoskeleton until they develop their own competence at reaching. So I think although therapists are always mindful of the context for movement, I think in our research, we also need to take into account how is this movement being studied and what happens if we vary the context.
Well, thanks for all of that, Linda. And this wraps up the fall edition of Pediatric Physical Therapy Podcast. I hope you've enjoyed the program and that you'll join us in 3 months' time. So until then, from Linda Fessers and from me, Peter Goodwin, goodbye.